This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer. Live your best life
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Welcome to the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. I'm Sonal Rupani, covering for Helen Farmer today. And we covered a lot of ground as we spoke about all things health today, starting with biohacking. It's a new trend that has been everywhere recently. Influencers giving competing levels of information. We got the story of one Dubai resident who's actually applied this to her own life and her own healing. In addition to that, got an expert on the line to understand how we can all start to look a little bit more into this sensibly. We spoke as well about how you can sleep a little bit better. I know I, for one, have a lot of sleep issues, and Julie Mallon was a great help in helping dissect which supplements are actually useful and what we can do away with. We also celebrated World Teachers Day today by talking a little bit about some of the measures that are put into place to target student anxiety. And finally, in the shifting perspective of consent and what that means, we talk about how people are looking back at different issues when it comes to appropriate behavior and how they can cope with that going forward.
Join the conversation on Afternoons with Helen Farmer
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You are listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer, except today it's with me, Sonal Rupani, Helen, and Zina, of course, Zina Zalameh alongside me. Helen is still making her way up Kilimanjaro. I've been trying to keep up with her different updates on Instagram. But you know how it is. Obviously, there was the outage yesterday. I've seen a little bits. I think at one point she got some coverage and we were able to see how she was going. So trying to keep up with that. But hopefully over the next few days, we'll get a little voice note from her on her progress as well. Now, today on the show, I want to talk about biohacking because this is something I've personally gotten really into. Zina, when I say that, do you have an idea of what I'm talking about?
I'm going to read off a website because I can't really explain biohacking, but it's basically a DIY biology aimed at improving performance, health, and well-being through strategic inventions. I've seen a few documentaries about this on Netflix. You know, mostly techpreneurs do this, and I'm not sure I buy into it 100%.
Yeah. I mean, there are so many outlandish things that you see, and it's hard to understand what to make of it, isn't it? And biohacking itself is such a broad term. At first, I thought biohacking was referencing when people fuse their bodies with technology, so the chips in the fingers, or in the hands, for example, things like that. But it can actually refer to that, and it can also refer to, as you mentioned, kind of DIYing your own biology, trying to figure out how the different processes in your body work and how you can improve your performance on different levels. So just a couple of examples that are out there. Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey is famous for this. He does a lot of intermittent fasting and drinks what he calls salt juice every morning. There's a NASA employee who's actually been trying to alter his genes, his DNA using CRISPR. There's also people in the Bay Area who get engaged with dopamine fasting. I mean, there are so many different terms. There's even a hockey player. His name is Duncan Keith, who has a lab in his house is what he calls it. He says... Whoa. He goes up there and does a bunch of little things to stay healthy. So could be anything from infrared lights to lying on a mat that has electromagnetic currents. I mean, people take this to such different levels. It's an odd thought.
And these are all, you know, high profile rich people. Where do they get this information? Where do they know what to do with their bodies to optimize performance? Because my GP won't tell me this.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we are going to have a doctor on the line at the end of this hour as well to understand a little bit better how this differs from conventional traditional medicine. But first, I want to get to a personal story. One of Caroline Leon. She is an individual who got interested in biohacking. She's been exploring it personally. But for her, it was not just a regular thing. It was in response to a pretty hopeless situation. She encountered a devastating accident and she faced it in 2015. Now, spoiler alert here, this week she is also attempting to climb Kilimanjaro, so it is safe to say that her recovery has gone pretty well. But I caught up with her just before she took off and she told me at the time her prospects were looking pretty bleak.
So I fell from an outdoor rock climbing wall and I smashed both my feet, my pelvis, my pubic bone, my right leg disconnected from my body, and I burst part of my spine. So I ended up in a hospital for over 2 months. And eventually when I was discharged from hospital, I was in a complete mess. I couldn't move my right leg at all. I could feel it, but I couldn't move it. I couldn't walk. I wasn't technically allowed to walk because I had so much surgery on my feet and so many plates. My feet were completely reconstructed. And at the time, I was looking for ways to help myself get really healthy. I didn't want to be injured and I didn't want to be confined to a wheelchair for the rest of my life. So I started reading quite a lot of information about people who were healing themselves through various different modalities. So I read about people who were healing their physical body because that's one layer of it. Then I was reading people who were healing their emotional body, particularly when you go through huge amounts of trauma like I did, and then how to kind of clean up and reshape your mind. And as I kept exploring, I was just experimenting on my own body with the physical aspects, with the emotional aspects, and with the mental aspects. How do I combine all of those so that I can get myself out of the mess that I found myself in, really?
There's so much I want to go into here. I mean, obviously the healing that we're talking about, which is the main focus of our chat today. But also, if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to know a little bit more about the accident. I mean, could you paint a picture for me about how you managed to sustain such a dramatic injury?
Yeah, of course. I was in an outdoor rock climbing wall in Dubai, and very silly of me, I climbed the wall unharnessed, and one of the inclots that I was holding onto came off, and I just fell, and I plummeted onto gravel. And at the time, my right foot had come out of my body. Obviously, my whole right leg had disconnected because my pelvis and my pubic bone just smashed. And my right leg actually shifted so that the whole leg had actually moved up into my rib cage. So initially, when I had this accident, I was just in complete shock. I didn't feel a lot of pain at the time, but I was in very much in shock. I lost a lot of blood. And when the ambulance arrived, they just rushed me to hospital. And what's interesting about being in hospital is that whether you're aware or not, you kind of fall into this medical machine to keep you alive and to save your life. And so immediately when I got to hospital, I was very much in shock and not really understanding what was happening or what happened. And I was rushed to surgery, and I had three surgeries that evening. And from that point on, for the next 2 months, I had almost a surgery every 3 or 4 days. And obviously, to keep me alive, I was given huge amounts of blood transfusions and lots of pain medication and just a huge assortment of like medical interventions just to keep me alive, really. So once I survived the initial few days, I remember the doctors actually telling me and my family that there was a huge possibility that I was never going to walk again because the injuries were so extensive. So they had managed to keep me alive. And from that point on, it was really about trying to fix all the damage that I had created.
It's difficult to even process that in terms of the physical recovery that you had to go through. But walk me through a little bit the mental side of it. Because as you mentioned, initially, there's that period of shock, but eventually there is probably some downtime in between those multiple surgeries that you're having. I mean, how do you start to mentally process what you're going through and also deal with that initial diagnosis, potentially not being able to walk again?
Yeah, it was very tough. I think one thing that I had that came actually to my advantage was that because I was so injured, I was given a lot of pain medication, but also there's faculties in your mind and within your physical body that kind of shut down in those early stages. So I lost a lot of my immediate memory. I wasn't able to read properly. I couldn't concentrate on words and I couldn't string a sentence together. The light was too bright, so I just had the lights off, or I was having a pillow over my head. Even short-term memory and conversations that I was having with people. So there's a lot of emotional aspects at the time. Like you get very, very emotional and very sensitive, and things, small things make you cry, but the mental aspect didn't actually come in till a lot later.
So that's how Caroline found herself in this pretty scary situation, both physically and mentally, finding herself grappling with a lot of different challenges after that accident. But how did she heal? That's ultimately what we're discussing today. What are some of the different approaches that she took away from conventional medicine that helped her get to Kilimanjaro, where she is today? What doesn't kill
you makes you stronger. This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You are listening to Afternoons today with Sonal as Helen takes on that challenge of climbing Kilimanjaro. Now, we're getting straight back into the story of Caroline Leon, who, as we heard, suffered a traumatic injury from a fall. This all has to do with biohacking.
Healthy habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Now, she told us how she shattered and shifted bones. She was told she might never walk again. So ultimately, the big question when it comes to health is, how did Caroline take matters into her own hands with her healing? And it turns out for her, it started very much with her mental strength.
I remember at the time I started reading Joe Dispenza. Well, actually, one of my friends was reading it to me. So I was gifted this book. And in the evenings, I had friends that would come in and sit with me. And I remember one of my friends reading Joe Dispenza's You Are the Placebo to me. And I remember listening to certain facets of it and thinking, okay, so everything that I think is so important to my recovery. And if I think that I'm never going to walk again, then I will absolutely solidify that fact and I will never walk again. And so I started playing with this idea of like, what if I did something different? What if I tried to walk? What if I tried to heal myself? What if I tried everything in my power that I could to recover? Perhaps I might. And slowly and slowly, I started to modulate my mentality to that place. But honestly, it was not an easy journey because you have, you know, people around you and doctors that are telling you that you're never going to walk. And you can physically see that, oh, actually, I've been living in hospital for 2 months. And then after that, I was living in a hospital bed at home for 2 years and I could barely stand. So having to fight the physical aspect of that is very, very challenging. And then the onslaught of kind of like emotions and depression that you go through, it's immense. But what I found so helpful is it was really about reading about other people's stories who had gone through, you know, life and death experiences and how they healed their bodies. And then just listening to a lot of the new age research about how incredibly capable the human body is and that your mind can really carve and map a way for you forward. And people have healed themselves from cancer. They've healed themselves from a huge assortment of conditions. And once I had all of this information, I was like, okay, I'm going to try this and let's see what happened.
Right. And I think a lot of us have been socialized into this world of traditional medicine, this world of, you know, science and facts and studies. And there seems to be, and I'm not saying there is, but at least perception wise, there seems to be a gulf between that and perhaps what you're discussing, the idea that with your mental shifts, you can actually create changes in your body. As you said, people who've changed their mentality and somehow managed to cure cancer. I think for a lot of people out there listening, that'll be a really difficult thing to wrap their head around. So tell me about how you found that compelling from an evidence-based point of view.
Of course. So I am probably going to butcher this. So I apologize in advance. I read a lot of this when I was in the most cognitive state. But from recollection, it kind of underlies this premise that if my thoughts have the ability to create an environment in my physical body. So for example, when I'm happy, my body is releasing dopamine. When I feel affectionate, it's releasing endorphins. When I do certain things or think certain things, then my body's releasing the associated chemicals. And those chemicals are released into the bloodstream and every single cell of your body that has a receptor to that will absorb that chemical. And it's almost like telling every person in a neighborhood, every house in a neighborhood, oh, we're happy right now. And that's essentially the power of your thoughts. So if you imagine like a neighborhood or a building. You're going to every single building, every single apartment in that building, and you're literally knocking on their door and you're giving them dopamine. And that dopamine means you're happy right now, or you're giving them serotonin, or you're giving them any neurotransmitter within your brain. And what that happens is it creates an environment within that cell. And then as a result, it just cascades on from there. So you would imagine if I'm knocking on someone's door and I'm giving them dopamine and telling them that they're happy, they might turn the lights on within that apartment and they might make some changes within the apartment because of the dopamine that I've given them. So it really helps to solidify the kind of the understanding, oh, okay, my thoughts create physical manifestations in terms of what chemicals are released in my body. And that creates an environment within my cells that actually cascade into other things. And that changes the cellular environment. So even things like having lots of oxygen. So if you're breathing correctly and you have an abundance of oxygen, you create a different environment within that cell.
Join the conversation on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Only on Dubai i103.8.
You are listening to Afternoons with Sonal today. Zena as well alongside me. Producer Milani as well in back of house. And we are talking about all things health.
Healthy habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Now, we've been hearing this hour from Caroline Leon. She went through a devastating injury, has basically tried to figure out both mentally, physically, and emotionally how she could heal in a better way. And she made it clear to me that she doesn't consider herself a biohacker, just a normal person who was looking into strategies to aid her recovery. She didn't really realize the term until much later. But what specific measures did she implement?
I was listening a little bit to the medical medium and a lot to the Gerson therapy. And so I started incorporating some juicing into my diet. And I know that that's quite a controversial topic because people talk about high blood sugar levels and that juicing isn't really an important facet. But I think when you are so malnourished, and when I left hospital, I was very, very, very frail and very thin and very, very just in a very bad state. So I wanted to get as many nutrients into my body so that I was literally just full of vitamins and minerals and nutrients. So I started doing a lot of juicing, so organic juicing using a cold press juicer. So that was the first thing. I started taking a lot of supplements. And at the time I was a vegetarian, but I actually switched to taking a lot of animal supplements. So I was taking desiccated liver tablets and collagen and marine collagen and bovine collagen and colostrum and some other animal supplements just to be able to, again, fill every part of my body with as much nutrition as possible.
Could I just jump in there for a quick question on that? Is when it comes to the world of supplements, there's so much out there. How did you determine the ones that you would eventually take?
So what, and again, I know that this protocol is quite controversial, but I actually used a kind of standard of practice that was run by the Gerson therapy. So I used that as a benchmark. And this is a holistic treatment modality that treats terminally ill cancer patients. So although I wasn't terminally ill with cancer, I wanted to use a strategy that was really aggressive in being able to get myself healthy. And so they incorporate a lot of juicing and a lot of animal supplements as well. And they sent me their protocol and the vitamin and supplement list. So they were giving very high doses of vitamin C. They were doing oxygen therapy. They were doing coffee enemas. And I incorporated colonics into that. Then I was doing infrared and light therapy, going to hyperbaric oxygen chambers, oxygenating my own blood, like just an immense amount of stuff that I did initially. So I did all of that for about the first year.
So that's the story of Caroline Leon, who went just 6 years ago from having a shattered pelvis, broken bones, multiple fractures, to essentially being ready to climb Kilimanjaro just years later. Now, she did make a point, as she said, she's not a biohacker herself, even though she practices some of these things. She says, do your own research. If this is an interesting area for you, I know there are a lot of different experts that are out there, a lot of resources online. She said, like she did, find what works for you and make sure you research it diligently. So big thanks to Caroline, and we wish her well as she treks up Kilimanjaro. Now, If this is a topic you've been interested in, there is so much information that's out there that it can be quite overwhelming. There are a lot of people, and I've seen this personally, citing scientific studies on either side of a completely opposing argument. And to help us make sense of it all, we're joined now by Dr. Nasser Al-Jafari. He's the medical director of DNA Health. He's an expert in functional medicine. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Nasser.
Many thanks. Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Nasser, I want to learn a little bit about your background, first of all, in terms of your experience with training as a doctor. At what point did you start to think beyond mainstream medicine and focus more on long-term health?
So I trained in a traditional system in the UK as a general practitioner. And early on in my career, I was also focused on just optimizing my own well-being. So I was very into kind of sport and training. So started to look really broadly at kind of the research about behind certain dietary protocols and supplementation, and really found that there was a lot of robust, promising research that had been going on for decades that no one had really told us about during our former sort of training, certainly during medical school. And at the same time, we have this concept of what's called numbers needed to treat in medicine. It's effectively how many people you have to treat with a single intervention to see an improvement. We also have a concept called numbers needed to harm. So how many people you need to treat to see a negative outcome with a single intervention. And I was finding that the research was showing that a lot of the common medications that we were giving to people were actually causing more harm than good for the majority of people. So I think just putting that together just sent me down a completely different path, reevaluated kind of what had been told to me during and training. And when actually starting to apply it to my clients, I started to see that it was actually far more efficacious.
Can you give me a couple of examples? Because that still feels quite broad to me. So maybe a couple of suggestions you were saying there, that as you were doing your own research, you were finding a lot of things that can make a big difference, but for some reason they weren't really being taught to you or emphasized. I mean, what are a few things that you think people could incorporate that is really proven scientifically to boost overall health?
Well, you know, a lot of it's not really that kind of fancy. I mean, you're hearing a lot now, probably one of the most researched diets is the kind of Mediterranean diet, which seems to pop its head up. You know, for the last 10, 15 years, there's been a huge evolution in our understanding of the gut and the gut microbiome. So back then there was, you know, studies coming out showing the application of different species of probiotics and how certain foods, particularly plant-based foods, can modulate the gut microbiome and its effect on immune function, for example. So, you know, if we want to keep it really simple, it's a case of incorporating a diverse range of plant-based foods. I mean, that's one easy concept. If we're looking at, for example, supplementing that, you know, simple things like omega-3 has huge anti-inflammatory benefits. You're hearing a lot now about vitamin D. I mean, vitamin D was never spoken about 15 years ago, but it's something that's on the tip of everyone's tongue. It's something we've all heard about with respect to COVID. So these are just very small examples of the sorts of things or simple interventions that people can put in their life that has huge, profound impact on general health and well-being.
You know, you talk there about a plant-based diet, and this is something I've had a particular interest in the past week or so, because I started watching Game Changers, that documentary that made headlines probably a year ago now, I think it was. Everybody was talking about elite athletes whose performance was actually improving due to switching to a plant-based diet. And on the flip side, I can see on social media channels a guy called Dave Asprey, who's really well known in the biohacking community, who is saying, I was a raw vegan, do not go vegan, it's the worst thing you can do. And both sides will cite scientific studies to make their case. So when you have a directly contradictory piece of advice that's being given to you by two different sources, both of them citing quote-unquote scientific research, how do you as a consumer, as just a layperson, make sense of that? How do you navigate it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think first of all, let me try and sort of dissect that for you. I mean, we could probably be here all day, but I think the important thing with nutritional studies is that you're often only seeing associations. So a lot of these studies are done either what we call prospectively or retrospectively. So people are given questionnaires and then followed up, or they're given questionnaires to give information about their lifestyle over the last 5-10 years. And then at the same time, people are looking at disease outcomes. So they're often not very robust quality studies. You can get what's called confounding variables. What we mean by that is, and I think probably taking an example is, you know, often you'll hear people talking about red meat's not good for you. You know, there's increased rates of cancer. Well, actually, when you dissect that and look at the statistics, it's actually not that true. Similarly, at the same time, is it because these people are eating red meat, or is it because those people who have the highest consumption of red meat also smoke? So these are things that you've got to consider that aren't portrayed in the kind of media headlines. I think also at the same time, nutrition, there's no one right type of nutrition. We have some general guidelines which certainly seem to apply to everyone with respect to health span and longevity. But it's really what suits you. And we now have the technology where we can look at people's genome and very sophisticated metabolics to actually direct and come up with sort of precision nutrition for those individuals. So that's kind of on the reason why you get conflicting information, but also people like to fit the research to their premise. Secondly, how do you dissect that information as a layperson? It's difficult. You do have to empower yourselves now, because you're not going to get the lifestyle information through mainstream sort of healthcare outlets. And I think it ultimately comes down to, you know, maybe empowering yourself and getting a basic understanding of how the research works, how to investigate or break down the research yourself, rather than just reading the headline and just going with trusted sources.
Join the conversation on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Sonal with you on Afternoons today, and we are going to get right back to speaking about biohacking.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are joined today by Dr. Nasser Al-Jafari, Medical Director of DNA Health. He is an expert in functional medicine. And we've kind of been determining what makes sense, how you can approach biohacking if you're new to this, and what how people can basically go about it. Now, one of the questions that's come in, Dr. Nasser, first of all, thank you for joining us and thanks for staying with us on the line. One of the questions that's come in from one of our listeners on this, no name on it, though, is asking about fasting. I've read a lot about fasting recently. Does it really help? And if I want to try it, what's the most effective way to do this?
Good question. So, yeah, people have been hearing a lot about fasting probably in the last few years. I would go as far to say that there probably isn't an intervention as therapeutic as fasting is, and also with respect to improving longevity. So, I mean, this is well researched and been proven that across different species, caloric restriction, particularly intermittent caloric restriction, has incredibly powerful what we call epigenetic effects. So how it affects the on-off switches of your genes. And it seems to have a positive impact on those genes that are, you know, most associated with longevity. So very powerful. Should it be something that everyone does? Yes. What is the prescription? We don't, unfortunately, have the research yet to say you have to be doing this amount of fasting for this amount of time over this period. But generally speaking, looking at it logically, I tend to recommend to my clients they do some form of what we call daily time restricted eating. That means eating their food within a certain time period each day. And that really just depends on the individual. But effectively, what you're trying to do is mimic what our ancestors were doing, which is effectively eating within daylight hours. And then doing kind of the occasional longer periods of fasting. And that's kind of 24 hours plus. And, you know, not to scare people, you really seem to get the epigenetic changes at 3 days plus. Now, there's a caveat. This is something that applies to most people, but certainly there are circumstances where we wouldn't expect people to do fasts for that long. So people who are pregnant, children, underweight, eating disorders. But for pretty much everyone else, it will have significant therapeutic value.
And now I know you just mentioned there that the research is still coming in on this, but just to get an idea, so does that mean having your last meal at, let's say, 7 p.m. and then not eating again, skipping breakfast perhaps, and not having food again until about noon, just to give me a rough idea of what you advise?
Yeah, exactly. So typically you're kind of trying to eat your food within an 8 to 10 hour eating window. I mean, there are some people who will shorten it, lengthen it. I think it's really about balance and what suits you. And some people will come back and say, well, what about breakfast? It's the most important meal of the day. Well, it is, in the sense that it just means it's your first meal of the day. So it doesn't need to be 7 a.m. The important thing is that it comes from the term breaking fast. So you need to be breaking a fast.
I love this because I've basically been doing this my whole life without knowing it, skipping breakfast. But just a really quick one for you, Dr. Nasser. We only have about 30 seconds left, but I'm thinking about cases that couldn't be solved with conventional medicine. Have you seen a specific example of certain conditions that people have been able to resolve better or improve perhaps with these biohacking techniques or functional medicine that perhaps conventional medicine couldn't really resolve?
100%. I mean, I would put them in two categories, which I'm seeing quite a lot of day to day. So those with a kind of traditional sort of disease diagnosis. So the classic is things like autoimmune conditions, thyroid disease, rheumatoid issues, gut issues. We're often using lifestyle to reverse these problems. I mean, I think the problem is that the systems led people to believe that a lot of these conditions are chronic in the sense that you have to just live with a certain amount of symptoms and signs and often have to live with medication. That's not, in fact, correct. And we are often getting people off medication.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Dr. Nasser. Sorry, that's all we have time for,
no problem.
Really appreciate your expertise on that. As Dr. Nasser Al-Jafari, Medical Director of DNA Health, he is an expert in functional medicine, as we said, and so many great tips and pieces of advice of how to navigate this particular area.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is the Sleep Clinic with Julie Mallon. She is the co-founder and director at Nurture. She's a sleep consultant, and we've already had messages coming in. There's such an interest in this topic. So over the course of this hour, she's going to try to solve your sleep issues. So at this point, Julie, thank you so much for joining us and welcoming you into the conversation.
You're most welcome. I'm very glad to be here. So thank you.
So, Julie, I'm just going to go ahead and start with some of my own personal challenges, because we've talked about this a little bit on our own show on Off Script. I am somebody who cannot get to sleep at night. And this is something for me that's only started about 2 to 3 years ago, and I think could be something that a lot of people will relate to. I can't sleep for hours just tossing and turning. And I tried something a little bit extreme yesterday that made Zena laugh at me. I literally counted sheep because I thought, you know what? I really want to go to bed. I'm not up for 2 hours of tossing and turning tonight. Let me just try this out. I imagined fluffy sheep hopping over a fence, and I counted them. And as ridiculous as it sounds, it actually kind of worked. For the first time in ages, I probably fell asleep within 20 minutes or so. Is this something that actually it's an old adage, but is there something to it?
There definitely is something to it. And somebody, you know, one of the leading neuroscientists in sleep in the world is Matthew Walker, who I'm sure you've heard of. And even he talks about counting sheep. But what you're actually doing is what is known as cognitive behavioral therapy. So you're actually going to you're taking yourself out of your emotional brain, and you're really blocking out the noise. Because if you think now in the 21st century, we are surrounded by noise and from every place. Now, interestingly, I heard your sleep was better, but I thought it was possibly due to the fact that, you know, WhatsApp, Instagram and Facebook went down. So, you know, people were forced to get off their devices. So that's actually what I thought might have been the reason for you sleeping better. But exactly as you were saying, you almost took you came out of your worry mind and you focused on what was going to enable you to block everything else out. So, yes, there is a lot in it.
Yeah, I mean, actually, now that you say it, that WhatsApp outage certainly would have helped. And I wonder how people reacted to it, you know, across our listener base, if this did affect people broadly in the ways that they were sleeping. I mean, we've had so many questions coming in for you already, and I want to get straight to these, actually. One that's come in from Anna: my husband has had sleeping issues for the past several years. He gets to bed between 11 to 12 p.m. and wakes up like clockwork at 5 a.m. This leaves him tired and often irritated. Sleeping tablets are not an option, as he's had minor heart issues. Is there anything that he can try?
I mean, there's a number of things that he can try in the respect. First of all, we need to look at our relationship with sleep and what we're doing during the day. You know, we can't see sleep and look at it in isolation, because we need to put all these other factors in place that are going to support good sleep, such as, you know, coming off his screen sufficiently early, you know, looking at his diet, what, you know, other things such as exercise. Is he getting enough exercise? And from an anxiety perspective, that we know will also impact sleep. So it's about quality, not just quantity. And there are so many studies that are supporting the fact that if the quality of our sleep is poor, it doesn't matter how much we've had. So it's how we can improve the quality of our sleep. And it is about lifestyle. I mean, there are supplements that you can take, but it's actually much better that we look at our in a very holistic perspective on how we can improve our sleep. And also, you know, us taking responsibility as opposed to looking at something like sleeping tablets, which this gentleman can't take, which should really be a very short term measure. But we need to look at our lifestyle and we need to look long term.
Join the conversation on Afternoons with Helen Farmer
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
I'm Sonal Rupani in for Helen Farmer today.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Happy to say that Julie Mallon, our sleep expert, is back on the line with us. She's the co-founder and director at Nurture. Julie, thanks for joining us today.
You're most welcome.
So we were discussing at one of our listeners' previous questions about how there's so many different lifestyle components that go into getting a good night's sleep, why some people face trouble getting to sleep. And I feel like this next question from Sunil plays into this a little bit as well. He says, I cannot sleep if I have the slightest stress. Also, if there's any disruption at all. I'm 50 years old male. I'm healthy otherwise. No major problems. My mother tended to have the same issue as well. And it made me think about what you were saying previously, just a few moments ago, about how anxiety, exercise play so much into this. I mean, those are big issues to resolve. What are ways that people can start to look at tackling these challenges when they know it's specifically anxiety or stress related? What can you do to help improve your sleep in those cases?
Well, the first thing is that you start small and have realistic expectations and move in baby steps. Because it is so overwhelming. And there's actually a new disorder now in terms of sleep, in anxiety about sleep. If we're looking at sleep trackers, if we're looking at, you know, stress in the workplace, and of course, COVID. COVID has had a huge impact on our anxiety levels and on our sleep. So it's really unpacking, again, our relationship with sleep and what our day is like. Now, in terms of anxiety, there's a number of practical things that we can do. You know, again, looking at our diet, if how healthy is our diet, are there supplements that we can take that might boost, you know, our sleep, that might relieve that anxiety and reduce anxiety? You know, there's different things such as HTP5. Now, this is a hormone which really helps to boost neurotransmitters and then relaxes our whole system in relation to sleeping. So when we are looking, for example, you know, there's quite a lot of research around HTP5 that shortens the time it takes us to fall asleep and increases the sleep amount. So that's why you would take something like 5-HTP. Now, again, these are sticking plasters. So we really need to get to know why, as a short-term measure, these are going to be helpful, but long term, like the sleeping tablets, we need to know what the real reason for our sleep is. What the poor sleep is a symptom of something else, and so that's what we would need to know.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
I am Sonal Rupani in for Helen Farmer today and through the rest of this week as she does her mountain climb. We're looking forward to hearing more about that when she returns next week. For now, though, we're getting back to the sleep clinic with Julie Mallon, the co-founder and director at Nurture.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Julie, thank you so much for staying with us. And we're looking forward to diving into some of the many questions that have come in. Somebody actually has sent in a message to say royal jelly tablet under the tongue before bedtime works a treat. And that got me thinking a little bit. First of all, if you have any thoughts about a royal jelly tablet, I'm not sure exactly what that is. But if you do have any knowledge of if that works. And other than that, if there are certain supplements that work, I'd love to go through a list of things that people are interested in trying. Is there anything that you think works particularly well? Julie?
Question. Just to go back to the first question, can you hear?
There you are.
Okay. In relation to sleep with the royal jelly, putting it under the tongue, the reason for that is because of the submucosa. So whatever it is going to be absorbed much more quickly into the whole system. So that's how that can be a positive. And actually, we are literally all individuals. And if that is working, then keep with it to carry on. But again, that in itself will not work alone. Again, it's, as we said from the very beginning, it's about looking at your lifestyle and your relationship that it has with sleep. We are looking at the three pillars of health. So exercise, nutrition, and sleep. Those are the three things that are absolutely critical for a good, well-balanced, healthy lifestyle. And without them, one of them is going to... each one of them doesn't take precedent over. Now, in terms of the other, you know, how we were talking a little bit before about different supplements, with the supplements, it's always really important that you make sure you check with your doctor about supplements that you are going to take, because they could interact within your system in a way that they haven't with other people. We don't know any of the sensitivities. Mm-hmm. But it is, that's why I'm saying it is a short-term measure, but make sure things are worked with your doctor first. Now, one of them, if we're looking at the supplements, we were saying before about magnesium. Now, magnesium is known as it's a deep sleep mineral. Now, this should be in a lot of our diets and food that we're eating, but because of, for example, our food coming from halfway around the world, the food is picked before it's ripe, so therefore the food is not absorbing all the nutrients. Now, how magnesium is good for sleep is that it actually relaxes the central nervous system. So that is the way in which it helps us in terms of sleeping. So having a magnesium supplement is a really helpful supplement for sleep. Now, the other thing about magnesium is that if you bath in the magnesium, salt, for example, this is five times more effective than if you were to take a capsule.
Really?
Five times more. And that's because your skin is the largest organ of the body. So we're exposing it to all of that magnesium. And that really does help.
That's really surprised me. I wasn't aware of that. What about a couple other natural kind of herbs? Lavender is one that's come up, as well as valerian root.
Now, valerian root is really interesting, as is lavender. Lavender, we know, has a calming impact. And a relaxing, and you can put, you know, a few drops on your pillow, and you can put some into the bath water, and those, it really does help to calm you. Now, in terms of the valerian, these help to boost the production of GABA. Now, GABA is the calming brain chemical that promotes sleep. So this is why valerian will be a good supplement to help. So we're still not quite certain, but it appears that the function is it's primarily to reduce anxiety. So that's why the valerian root can be helpful. And you can get that either as a capsule, or we can have it in teas. So those are things that will really help.
And another question, and this is one that comes up for a lot of people that have trouble sleeping, is melatonin. Now, I know people that are sort of scared to look into this or to take it. How can somebody take this without feeling fear of any side effects? Let's say grogginess in the morning. What do you have to consider if you're looking at this as a solution?
The thing to remember here, very much about taking melatonin, is it's synthetic. Now, the body produces melatonin, and as a synthetic hormone, when you are taking that, when the melatonin goes to the brain doesn't recognize it readily. And there are a number of side effects with the melatonin, you know, such as, you know, headaches, mood swings, because it is synthetic. Now, you've got to look at why you're taking the melatonin. It can be helpful in terms of reducing the impact of jet lag. So, again, a short-term measure. But we've also got to look at when we take the melatonin, it's helpful to take it about 90 minutes before you go to bed. So there's no point in taking melatonin right before you go to bed, because that's not going to help with your sleep. And also, we need to know or recognize the function of melatonin. Melatonin, it triggers sleep. So it's not a sedative. That's what I'm trying to say. Melatonin is not a sedative. So it triggers a signal to the brain to commence our sleep. So it's almost like, you know, when we're having the Olympics and you've got the person starting the race, that's the role of melatonin. So it starts our sleep. And then the second thing, which is really important here, is melatonin doesn't have a very long shelf life. And therefore, in order to maintain the authenticity of what it is saying on the pack, very often it can have as much as 80% more melatonin in terms of its quantity than what it actually does say on the box. Because if the FDA come in, for example, at any point and say, okay, so this said it should have this amount, let's test it. So in order to avoid it, so we have to be very, very mindful of what we are taking.
Right. And just your very quick thoughts on this, Dr. Julie. Can acupressure or acupuncture work to help people who have sleeping issues?
Yes, it absolutely can. It can.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for your time, Dr. Julie. I know a lot of people have sleeping issues and have gotten a lot out of that advice. A lot of people asking for your details, of course. That's Dr. Julie Mallon. How can they find you?
First of all, to correct you, not wishing to be rude, I'm not a doctor. I am a sleep specialist, but I'm not a doctor. You can go to Nurture to Sleep on my Instagram, which is 2 as in number 2. But as you're liking facts, we spend on average 27 years of our lives sleep. Also, in comparison to 11 years of working. So that will just tell you the importance of sleep.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for spending some time with us, and we look forward to having you back on again soon.
You're most welcome. I've really enjoyed it, and thank you.
Thank you.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer, Sonal Rupani, in with you today with Zina Zalamea, of course. And as we've mentioned, it is World Teacher Day, and we've already got some messages coming in. We're going to get to some stories about teachers that you'd like to thank. We're also speaking about a unique and creative method that one school here is using to tackle anxiety in students.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
So I want to get first to this message from Siog. A big shout out to our wonderful team of teachers in Littleland Montessori Nursery, where minimizing anxiety and maximizing self-confidence is their top priority. Lots of love to them all. That's a very sweet message. Z, do you have a favorite teacher when you think about World Teacher Day? Is there anybody that comes to mind off the top of your head?
Yes, there's a teacher in my school. Her name was Leah, and she had very short hair, which was quite unusual in my school. It was an all-girls Catholic school. But yeah, and she loved manga and things like that. She was just different. So I thought, yeah, I can be different too and not be seen as an outcast or weird.
That's nice. I like that.
Yeah.
We are going to be catching up in a few minutes with an educator who's going out of his way to address an issue that's definitely becoming more prevalent, anxiety among students. And you and I were talking about this a little bit earlier, but as older millennials, can we call ourselves older millennials or just millennials, let's say, anxiety for us was something I don't recall it ever being something that was discussed in school. It wasn't really on the map. It wasn't something that we talked about. Do you look back at that and think about if that could have been, if that was something that affected you or if it could have been managed better from a schooling point of view?
Definitely. It definitely existed, but I'm just realizing it now. And now that it has a name, it has a label, I wish I could have, you know, looking back, I wish I could have done something about it.
Well, this is something that's definitely changing now. In fact, today's teens and young adults are the most anxious ever, according to a study. This is a study based in the U.S. A Pew survey found that 70% of teens say anxiety and depression is a major problem among their peers. An additional 26% say it's a minor problem. So there you have 96% saying it's an issue in total, which is really a shocking statistic. And this is something that now is starting to change as there's more awareness today. Schools in Dubai as well have become more competitive. They're also focused on the overall well-being of students. And we've got Liam Cullinan, the head of secondary for Nord Anglia School, joining us to talk about a special initiative that they've taken on. Good afternoon, Liam.
Good afternoon, everybody. How are we all?
Wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on the line with us. And first of all, I have to wish you happy World Teachers Day.
Well, thank you very much. A bit of Simply Red in the background is a great way to celebrate. So thank you for playing that.
I'm glad you enjoyed that. Did your students get up to anything today? Was there any specific appreciation measures?
There's been a lovely gesture where there was a Padlet put out to parents and students, actually, to thank teachers from a range of subjects across the school. So there's been some lovely words and messages shared with the staff body today. So they were bouncing around the corridors today. I haven't read the messages. So very grateful colleagues.
That is so lovely. And you know what? I think you must have heard the statistic that I just read out about anxiety. Yeah. I know this is something that you have been keen on addressing and talking about, vocalizing a little bit more. I mean, with your experience as an educator, do you feel like you've seen a higher rate of anxiety among students more recently? Or is this something that you feel is just getting picked up? We're more alert to it now.
You know, I think the people who are more alert to it, as you both alluded to, is the students themselves. There's a growing understanding of well-being, right? There's a growing understanding of how we're accountable for our roles as educators of impacting on young people's well-being, but also students taking accountability and responsibility for their well-being and working with schools in a more open, transparent dialogue about how we might be impacting, ways that we can support and look after each other. Because, you know, I often say this, every child is unique and every child is a gift and talented. And what we've got to find out is how we reduce these outwardly pressures that are put upon them on a daily basis. And it can be different for every individual. Anxiety actually crosses such a broad spectrum of things. And what you've got to do is really dig into the issues. And you've got to have a staff body, a student body, a parent body who are aware of how we can look after these wonderful young people that we get to work with each day.
I think that's a really good point that you made about anxiety being such a broad thing, that we use this catch-all term anxiety, but really it means so many different and specific things. And you at your school are taking a specific measure to address some of this. So tell me a little bit more about this well-being room and your peer listener program that you have initiated.
Yeah, well, you know, one thing that you've got to celebrate that the KHDA do is the Dubai Schools Wellbeing Census, which allows all schools to have their students take part in a wellbeing census, which gives us a huge amount of data about our young people. And then we follow that up with what's called PASS, which is a pupil's attitude to school and to self, which highlighted to us that their students were experience anxiety and also were not always understanding the platforms to be able to communicate that. So therefore, two programs were developed. And the first one that I am going to talk about is the peer listening, because I think we believe sometimes as educators and adults that students will come and communicate to us. But my experiences as teenagers, and I do articulate this in many of my assemblies, is I remember being a 4 or 5-year-old, it was all mummy, 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 mummy. And then as you get a little bit older, then maybe it's less of that as you hit the teenage years, where you maybe close your doors a little bit more often and you communicate through different platforms and different experiences. So we do utilize our teachers. But as we get older, it's peer-to-peer, right? It's friendship groups. It's those kind of things. So, and we've trained and worked with outside agencies to develop a peer listening program that enables our students to have the ability to listen. And listening skill is such an important thing in today's society, and to understand cues, keywords, understanding a hidden message that another individual might be communicating to them. So that's where the peer listening came from. But following on from that, we run an innovation hub, and one of our students, Claudia Earle, who's a stunning young lady who recognized through experiences that people close to her were having that actually there's opportunities for the school to do more. And with her drive and with her commitment and the voice of many students she worked alongside, she proposed us creating a well-being area in the school, which is completely different. I know you're speaking to Claudia later, so I won't steal her thunder to talk about the amazing things she's developed, because credit where credit's due, young people know each other very, very well. And schools who refuse to listen to the voice of youth are missing an opportunity to make a really deep, enriching, meaningful and life learning experience for those people.
That's a perfect introduction to Claudia, because we are going to be speaking to her in just a few minutes. And before we break here, I do want to read out a message, a bit of fan mail that's come in for you. Liam Cullinan is an amazing person, headmaster. He sticks out as an educator for our boys, and he's been instrumental in supporting them. That's from the Chap family. So a little bit of appreciation on World Teachers Day for you there, Liam. Appreciation from us as well, because thank you so much for joining us and walking us through some of these issues. We're looking forward to chatting with Claudia in just a few moments. But thank you for joining us on the line.
Thank you for your time.
Take care. What doesn't kill you
makes you stronger. This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
This is, in fact, Sonal Rupani in for Helen Farmer today. Zina Zalamea with me as well. We've been speaking to Liam Cullinan, the head of secretary at Nord Anglia School in Dubai, about student anxiety, about how he and his students are trying to address this issue a little bit. So you and I were talking about anxiety as school children, about how it was something that, do you think, it wasn't really addressed when we were growing up. And I was having this thought of, do you think actually not paying too much attention to it helps you kind of push on through it? Is that a healthy thing or not? I can't really make up my mind about that.
You know what? I'm not sure. But, you know, ignoring it doesn't make it go away. Sometimes it gets worse as you get older and you make the worst life decision. So I don't know. Yeah, we need a therapist.
I think it would be quite nice to have a well-being room in the school. I think this is definitely a good move and a good change. And in fact, we've been speaking to Liam Cullinan from the school, but also he mentioned there the student Claudia Earl, who came up with the idea of setting up this well-being room. And we're very happy to be joined by Claudia as we speak. Good afternoon, Claudia.
Good afternoon.
Thanks so much for coming on the line to talk to us a little bit about your initiative. I mean, just to start with, first of all, I guess, tell me a little bit of a background. What year are you in school?
So right now, I'm currently in year 13 at Nordanger Dubai.
And how did you come up with the idea for this well-being room? Why did you think this was something that your school needed?
So I think it was definitely one of a few initiatives that I had, and I thought definitely having a well-being space would sort of, it'd be an area that wouldn't really remind people of school. It would sort of be like a maybe a safe haven inside school that you could just go to when you were feeling stressed, and you sort of you'd be surrounded by, you know, your friends, and you could just talk there, and it would just be a nice place to sort of just relax and chill out.
And you know, being a student now is different from when Zina and I were students. So tell us a little bit about this level of anxiety that we're hearing reported. I mean, what are some of the sources of this stress and anxiety that you and your peers are facing when you talk about it? What are some of the key issues that come up?
So I think, like we said before, it's definitely a broad spectrum of things. So currently for like the older students, it would be maybe more academic pressure and maybe having difficulty balancing social life and academics at the same time, and also the fact that we're applying to university soon, so we're making big decisions that will probably impact the rest of our lives. But I think through peer listening as well, I found out that our anxieties are definitely a lot different to maybe students who were just entering secondary. So for them, it's more social, so making new friends, finding a group to fit in.
Right. And tell us a little bit more about the well-being room and how this has helped to address the issue. So describe it to me as if I was there. If I was a student entering the well-being room, what exactly would I experience? What would be going on inside that would help me address some of these issues?
So I think definitely the first thing that stands out in the room is the number of plants, which I think is really great because it's definitely a nice contrast to what you usually see in Dubai. And I think just the fact that there's nature surrounding you, I think there's definitely scientific research that backs the fact that nature does help you feel more relaxed and does help you make you feel happier. And there's also pastel furniture, and we decided to have like different pops of color that I thought would sort of contrast to what you see around the school as well. And I thought pastel would be a more relaxing colors for students.
That's a really lovely initiative, and Claudia, congratulations to you for actually executing it and coming up with something and taking the initiative to make it happen. It seems to be something that's really helped your school out. So thanks for coming on the line and telling us a little bit about it.
Thank you very much.
Brilliant. That was Claudia Earl. She is a student at Nord Anglia School in Dubai. And as you heard there, she's helped to initiate a new well-being room. And I have to say, as she was describing it there, I did think that would be a nice thing to have at work, wouldn't it? Just a place that's a little bit calm, a little bit zen. Hopefully it's the type of initiative that takes off in schools across the country and even, who knows, across the world. It is an issue that children have been facing, anxiety. I think we all remember that stress that comes with graduating, with schoolwork, social anxiety as well, so many different issues that it's helping to address.
You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation on Dubai Eye 103.8.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer, but today and for the rest of this week with Sonal, because I'm covering for Helen as she's off on her epic journey on Kilimanjaro. Zina Zalamea alongside me as always as well. We're talking a little bit of psychology for now as we round up the rest of this half hour, and it's really all related to a topic that's caught my interest lately. I've seen a couple of articles on this. Most recently, Emily Ratajkowski accusing the singer of Robin Thicke of groping her while they were filming the Blurred Lines music video in 2013. I think a lot of people will remember that video. It was a controversial song at the time as well. The thing about it that really struck me is this is a story from 8 years ago. And it's the kind of casual encounter that you can kind of imagine happening in 2013 without causing too much of a fuss. But if you imagine something like that today, there is absolutely no way. You cannot conceive of anything even close to this happening today. And if it did, that it wouldn't immediately be outed because times have changed, right, Z?
Yeah. Over the recent decades, definitely. And I bet a lot of people are going through, you know, previous tweets and TV shows and basically calling out actors and other celebrities for the things they've said and done.
Yeah, I mean, I saw another article as well about the CNN anchor Chris Cuomo just casually grabbing his former boss inappropriately in public. Once again, these are all old stories from the past that are coming back now. And it's fair to say that our societal expectations of appropriate behavior, both in the workplace but in all walks of life, has very much evolved, especially in the past 5 years or so when it comes to the Me Too movement, especially when it comes to our expectations around consent as well. Now, reading these articles, I did think there is going to be so many people out there who are looking back on previous encounters that they might have had and felt a little bit uncomfortable, but then kind of swept it under the rug and perhaps now are revisiting that, looking back on it with a fresh lens of appropriate standards of consent, maybe thinking, actually, you know what, that wasn't really okay. So we've got an expert on the line. Dr. Karen Hillier, psychologist at Open Minds, currently joins us. Good afternoon, Dr. Karen.
Good afternoon. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us to talk about this topic, because I do think it's an important one to discuss, and it is a little bit sensitive. But when we talk about reevaluating a past experience, coming to the realization perhaps that something wasn't as consensual as you led yourself to believe, that can be quite a difficult thing to process, both mentally and emotionally.
Oh, for sure. And I think you can look at it from the victim's perspective in terms of them understanding this behavior that maybe I didn't feel particularly comfortable with, but I didn't know what to call it, or I didn't know whether, you know, my feelings at the time were valid. And then you have the perpetrator or the person who did it and their perspective and them understanding that, as you mentioned, social norms and what is considered appropriate does change. I think for a lot of the time, women or victims have always been uncomfortable, but they haven't known how to call that out of fear that they're going to be dismissed as overly dramatic or drawing attention to themselves or seeing something that's not actually there. So for a lot of men and people in the community, it's having them reevaluate what their own behavior was. And that can be quite confronting for them to look back and realize that behavior that they might have done in the past made someone really uncomfortable.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to break down both sides of that a little bit. So starting with the person who, and I don't want to call it a victim because, again, these are confusing situations, but the person who felt aggrieved by that particular situation. What are some of the consequences of sweeping things like this? Something that perhaps isn't major, but that kind of minor, I don't want to call it major or minor, but those smaller sexual harassments or assaults that are easier to have a blurred line with, and burying it under a rug instead of facing it directly. What's the consequence of that?
Yeah, I mean, from one perspective, you have this issue of then people will start to question their own intuitions. You know, if I do feel uncomfortable about this, can I actually rely on that as a real indicator of what the situation is? So it can feed a lot of self-doubt in terms of trusting your own, your gut instinct in terms of situations. And more broadly, you have this issue of, is this normalizing behavior? Because if you don't comment about it, then people might then misconstrue that this is something that is acceptable behavior. And so it's more likely to be repeated, not just to you individually, but to other people in that workplace or in that community.
And what advice would you have for people who are going through this exercise of navigating maybe a fresh wound from an old incident? We are talking about sexual harassment at the moment, but I suppose this could apply to uncovering a number of different things from your past that you start to look at a little bit differently. What are some ways that people can take a healthy approach to this?
So I think it's what's been really good about movements like the Me Too movement is giving people a language and a jargon to use to be able to call out these types of behaviors. And it doesn't necessarily have to be in a confronting or an aggressive sort of way, because something that I do talk about with people is that you can address the behavior, but don't assume intent. So someone might have done something which does make you uncomfortable, but do you know that that's what they were trying to do? Or is it a, you know, it's an awkward attempt to try to build rapport, or start a conversation, and it just doesn't sit well with you? And so still being respectful and using that respectful language, but calling things out. And that's not just the person who experiences it, but other people around them, these bystanders, also need to feel comfortable in calling out this behavior as well. So if you're at a party and then someone makes a comment that you don't think is particularly appropriate or fair, or, you know, that can be seen as quite offensive, pointing that out to people. And so you might preface it by saying, look, I'm sure your intent is not to make her or to make me uncomfortable. But when you say something like that, then it makes me feel. So that's a very common assertiveness technique. So when you specify the behavior that they've done, and then you're commenting on how that makes you feel, because then they can't get defensive about the behavior because you're not implying that they did anything deliberately. Now that then gets more problematic and more difficult to navigate when you're feeling this is a systematic problem and I've raised this and I've tried to be respectful and it doesn't seem to be going anywhere. And then it's a matter of looking at whether larger systems like organizations have procedures in place that will make people feel comfortable to escalate a complaint or something if they feel that they need to.
Right. And I think that's a really important distinction to make, and one that I hadn't really thought about. But, you know, there's how you felt, how it was perceived, but of course the intent of the other person. Now, let's say you have spent some time to process something, that an experience that you've been through. It's also important to, I guess, release or let go of any burden of a negative experience. What is a way that people can go about releasing something that does tend to weigh heavily on them?
The first step is often good just to label it in terms of what happened, because often we will, and there's lots of social pressures, particularly amongst women, to like not make a fuss and to not make other people uncomfortable. And so we will take on that emotional burden a lot of the time. But I might be working with a client and then they might comment that something has happened to them, and we'll explore that. And I might explain to them that, you know, from a legal perspective, you know, that's classed as sexual harassment or sexual assault or rape or these types of things, so that they can start to be able to understand it with that type of language. And then it's looking at understanding that whatever it is that you did was not your fault that someone chose to behave in that particular way. Again, sometimes it can be, well, you know, she was behaving in a particular way, or there was this situation arose, and so someone might have thought that it was okay to make this type of comment, and that it's not, but it's okay for you to point that out. I think what gets really tricky for people from a consent perspective is this notion that consent is dynamic, and so it does change over time. So I might initially agree to one thing, and then my understanding of that changes, or my understanding of the person changes, and so then I am no longer consenting to that.
Right.
And so then how people will again get upset with this, yeah, but you said that this was okay, and you go, well, that was before, but I'm telling you that it's not now. So it's a lot to ask people to stand up and to assert their rights. That can feel really uncomfortable. And again, we've been socialized a lot in regards to that this is, you're going to look overly demanding, or deliberately trying to take offense in order to make a point or something. And so we're battling a lot of those societal norms that a lot of this stuff was considered totally fine. And those perceptions are slowly shifting, but it does take time. So hearing those reports from other people can help us to understand that own emotional experience that we had in trying to deal with it. But it is a matter of being comfortable in pointing out behavior that you don't feel comfortable with, because if you don't point it out, no one is a mind reader. We might like to think, oh, people should know that that is not appropriate, but people are learning. And so it's important for us to also give them the opportunity to have that learning experience. It then becomes a different issue if they're choosing not to take that learning experience.
Right.
And there's a different intent behind the behavior.
Dr. Karen, thank you so much for your thoughts on this, because it is a complicated area to navigate, especially when it comes to in the moment and in practice. So I think those are really helpful things for people to consider. So really appreciate your time today.
No problem. Thank you.
That was the voice of Dr. Karen Hillier. She's a psychologist at Open Minds. And it is a very interesting topic. And it was helpful, I think, to get a little bit of perspective on that.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hope you enjoy this podcast. And just remember, Afternoons with Helen Farmer is live every single weekday on Dubai Eye 103.8 from 2 to 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.